You're listening to the Cash and Burn podcast, and I'm your host, Brandon Metcalf. Join me as I interview and have conversations with founders and leaders about the greatest obstacles and challenges they've faced while building their businesses. Learn how they overcame them and ultimately what made them successful. The podcast is brought to you by Place. Place is a B2B SaaS customer subscription management, billing, forecasting, and metrics platform powered by Salesforce. Growing SaaS businesses use Place to better align their revenue and finance teams so they can boost revenue growth and retention, manage renewals, collect cash faster, and make more informed decisions all directly inside of Salesforce. Hey everyone, welcome back to Cash and Burn. Today I have Andrew McKay, the CEO and founder of Kona Search. I'm excited to have you on, Andrew. I know you and I are both in London this week for Salesforce World Tour, which is super exciting. And then we're having this our staffing and recruiting happy hour on Thursday night, which will be fun. So welcome.
Thank you very much, Brandon. Yeah, I'm looking forward to London. It's one of my favorite destinations outside the United States. So I'll have a great time. And of course, World Tour events are run so well by Salesforce that it's hard not to.
London World Tour is like the second biggest Salesforce event that Salesforce hosts outside of Dreamforce.
Yeah, I understand that they actually had to stop accepting people showing up because they hit the fire code limit.
Yeah, so I think about 10,000 people are supposed to come, so it's going to be fun. So I'll see you there on Thursday, but why don't we get all started by who in the heck are you? What do you guys do? Give us some background.
Yeah, I'm a serial startup guy. You can see that if you look me up on LinkedIn. People ask, why do you do that? And I said, because I have a really low boredom tolerance. So once we start up a company, get it going, and we sell it off, the second thing that I learned from that is never overstay your welcome at the buying company, because eventually you'll start hating each other at a passionate level. Move on to the next one. But unless you're able to transition, then good for you. I was never able to successfully do that long term. But right now, I'm currently the CEO and founder of Kona Search. Kona Search, an app on the App Exchange. I've been in the search industry, enterprise search industry, since 2001, which I'd like to think I started when I was 8 years old, just to pretend I'm not as old as I am. But with a company called Fast Search and Transfer, we sold that to Microsoft. And then with a company called Ativio, which sold to ServiceNow. And my latest is Kona Search. We brought in Salesforce into our company at Ativio. And I went, I really like this company. I like where it's going in the cloud. So I can build a search engine for it. And apparently people wanted it. So we did that and created Fast Search and Transfer. We created Kona Search, and here we are today.
Yeah, what you guys are doing, like when we first got introduced to you at Assemble, I'd never seen anything like how you guys search. And like Assemble's partnering with Kona Search for candidate search and match, right? For finding candidates for jobs. But it's fascinating that your product can actually search all of Salesforce and not just like one specific data table. And I haven't seen that in any other search product I've ever looked at.
You know, it's interesting you say that. And I'm glad that you saw that without us actually saying that, which I went back to my marketing guy and said, you should say this. The reality is, though, is that we tend to think that we do things that everybody else does and they don't. You're right. If you look at global search in Salesforce, you get results back one object at a time. But the actual physical schema of an org is only really known by the designer or the system administrator. From a conceptual point of view, users see it at a higher level or a logical schema. Now, I bring those terms up because before I was in the search industry, I was in the database industry. I'm a consulting company specializing in business intelligence and data warehousing and ETL. I had an ETL tool company that we started up and then we sold. And then for a while, I was over at Sybase as one of the chief architects. Really dating myself on that one, by the way. But the reality was is that I looked at the technology and I said, you know, for ad hoc querying, for what if analysis, the relational database, by the way, agreed to by the person who invented it, is the wrong technology. It actually should be search indices, search indexes, which are very much structured differently. And in doing that, I realized that this opens up the door for bringing together structured and unstructured data into one context, which is what, actually, after all, what users really want. They don't really care about the structure of the data. They just know what they're looking for. So let's say, for example, I want to find all the information about candidates in a staffing company. Well, the candidate record itself is just one piece of it. There's also the history of their education, the history of their jobs, and their attached resumes, CVs, and cover letters. All of those should be searched as if they were part of that candidate. And searching through those relationships and automatically handling the cardinality behind it is actually what we do. And we realize that that actually is something we do uniquely. And the other thing that we do is, even if those records or those attachments are sitting outside of Salesforce, we will still search them semantically as if they were part of the parent object, meaning that you could have stuff sitting in SharePoint or S3 and still keep the eyeballs in Salesforce as if Salesforce was your corporate desktop.
Yeah, which we love, especially with all things that assemble, because you know our philosophy is to allow you to assemble your tech stack on Salesforce. But there's some things that, you know, like the example about SharePoint, that may not be stored actually inside of Salesforce, but you can still surface it and see it and operate with it inside of Salesforce. So it's super cool. I think you guys are onto something, again, that I've never seen anyone else do. And I think it's exciting, especially for us in the talent space for that. Well, let's get into, like, you know, obviously, you know, the theme of the show. I always like to talk about challenges and struggles and the situations that you go through with building a company. And, you know, I'm not quite as many as you. I have I've had a total of four companies now, and you got me beat by one. So with that comes a lot of learnings and stress and tall tasks that feel like they're going to kill you. What are some of the challenges that you face that you'd want to share?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Brandon. I would say 4.5, because one of them I sold was my own consulting company when I moved from. So I put that. That counts. I sold my customers basically. But yeah, you know, to be honest with you, these are patterns that I would imagine are not a surprise to you as well. And I could think of three basic areas. One is, make sure you get your funding right. And what does that actually mean? Well, yes, of course, make sure that you get the right amount of money and that your tranche roadmap makes sense and it matches your product roadmap and your operational growth. But the other one I found was that there's a double-edged sword of who you get investment from, whether it's private or it's VC. And I've done both. And it's interesting, on the private side or on the VC side, you get VCs that understand your business and your industry, and they are really instrumental in some cases in finding your alpha clients and helping you create that initial brand awareness and thought leadership that you wouldn't otherwise have, because they can introduce you to all the right people. The other side of this that coin is that VCs tend to push towards hyper growth at all costs. And sometimes that's not in line with how you see your company growing. And as a CEO, be aware that you're going to spend an awful lot of time with them staring at spreadsheets, which is like make your bed stuff, but still, you just have to know that. The private equity side, well, they leave you alone so you can just run your business. The problem with that is they just leave you alone. So you don't get any help. You know, as long as the check shows up on time and you're showing revenue and eventually profit, then you're fine. But you don't get any of those introductions to high-powered, influential people or anything else. You're on your own, and don't underestimate that at the very beginning. The other thing that happens is the acts of God. So one is the private investment person, and this is actually what happened in the early days of Kona. I had a private investor for a seed, nice guy, was a family fund. He had about $200 million or something in the entire fund. But he remarried, and they decided to divest of the whole thing and invested in something, stuff to save the world, which is honorable, and more power to them, except that all of the companies in the funds were just told, that's it, the spigot just got turned off. And we were just shy of profit. So thankfully, a minor investor, an old friend of mine since 2001, decided to pick up the slack, and we were able to continue and grow. But always be wary of those acts of God. But they both have ups and downs. So that's number one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my background's kind of similar, where I've actually raised more money from angel or private investors than I have institutional. But both have been great. I mean, at Talent Rover, my first business, we raised about $28 million. About 25 of that came from about 15 to 18, somewhere around there, angel investors that, you know, invested quite a bit of money into the company. And then We won a large customer, and that customer put in $3 million at the end. And it was really interesting because, you know, what you're saying about they kind of stay out of your hair is very true. One of the things that I tried to do to change that dynamic is constantly seeking input from them. And some of the investors bought into that and really liked it. And just like, it's kind of like at Place too. One of my current companies, you know, we haven't raised $28 million. We've raised about $12 million for this business. And about, I don't know, eight or nine of that has been from private investors. And then the rest from our VC, where it's kind of the same thing where you have some of these angel investors who love to get directly engaged and involved. And I always do quarterly updates for all the investors to give as much detail as possible, because I learned a long time ago, you can't always just share the good news. Like, it's actually more meaningful to share the bad news and share the struggles and share the issues, because that's how I've gotten the individuals to give me more, to give me more input. But the actual hands-on support I've gotten far more from my VC. But I've also, like, I think to your point about who do you raise money from? It's not just which angels and which, it's not just going to an angel or going to an institutional, it's who in those. So, like, we were fortunate with Place. When we went to raise for Place, I got multiple term sheets from different VCs, and I picked one that I knew, and they've been the biggest support and the biggest cheerleader in the toughest times of Place, of just keep going. You're going to get through this. We have faith. We know where this is going to go. And I'm so thankful that we picked them to back us. So getting the right funding, I love this topic because it's the heartbeat of the business. And if you screw this up and choose the wrong people, your life can be very, very challenging if you are getting investors that just demand spreadsheets all the time versus generating value.
Yeah, well said. I mean, you're absolutely right. Think of it as you're hiring your investor the same way you would hire your core executive staff, which is the second point. So this is a nice segue into that. You have to be able to work with them as if you were joined at the hip, because if you can't, and you may have immense respect for them, and on paper, they have everything you need. But if you can't stand to be in the same room as them, there's no way it's going to succeed.
Yeah.
It has to be at a personal level to some degree. And certainly it works in both directions as well. So generally speaking, the investors are smart enough to know that, like, yeah, I love your company. I think you got a great idea. I just can't stand you, so I'm not giving you any money.
So, yeah, I mean, especially in the early days, because all the investors invest in you as the person with the confidence that you're going to deliver the return for them. More so, I think, than what the company does. And then I think as you get a little bit later into the company and you start to have metrics and data and you can actually see performance, then that starts to shift a little bit where you're investing more of what's the opportunity with the business and a little less than on who the founder is.
Exactly. Yeah. But that leads to the second point. And the second point is that you don't underestimate, this might be the most important thing that you'll ever do, but don't underestimate who you hire as your core leadership team. And to be honest with you, it's an overused phrase, but, you know, hire slowly, fire quickly. You know, to be honest with you, that's not a trivial statement, because what happens, I think, is a slow killer in a company aren't the people that are obviously not able to do the job, or the ones that are obviously succeeding at the job. It's the mediocrity in between, because there's always a reason to keep a person, because nobody personally likes to fire people. My mantra is always, I made a mistake if I ever have to get rid of somebody, because I shouldn't have hired them in the first place. But if you fall into that trap of coming up for the reasons why you should still keep them around, it's the slow cancer that will kill your company.
I mean, it always is. And it's like, I learned, in my CEO group, we had a gentleman come in who's the CEO of a multi-billion-dollar company, and he was talking, and you know, he said something that has stuck with me. He's like, when's the best time to fire someone? When you think of it. And it's a bold statement, but it's kind of true. It's like, if you have in your mind that this person's not working, and you've got to determine, can you help them fix that and actually get to a point where they can be successful and deliver for the company? Or are you just avoiding making the tough decision of like, this isn't going to work. One of the guys I used to work with in recruiting back in my staffing days, he said, every ass has a seat. And your job as a recruiter is to find the right seat for the right butt. And when you do that, the person's going to flourish and the company's going to flourish and it all works. And, you know, I've always looked at terminating people as the least favorite part of anything I do, but it also is like, you got to make the tough decision, because if it's not right for the company, it's also not right for the person who's in the role. And hopefully they can go find something that is much more efficient for them or much, much better for them.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I totally agree. I have a mantra that I use all the time. One is, the person's talent must be the same as what they desire to do for their career. And that also must be the same as what is needed for the company. If any one of those three are out of alignment, rethink the hire.
I also liked what you were saying about, you know, being able to have a coworker, which is one of the things I talk about too. Like, I learned early in my career that, and I learned this from my boss who did this to me. Like, when I introduced someone that I was out to lunch with and I had someone that worked with me there, if they were like one of my direct reports, I would still say, here's Sally, she works with me, not here's Sally, she works for me. And instilling that mindset of like, look, we're all in the same company. We have different jobs. We have different responsibilities and we answer to different people. But at the same time, like, we're all just trying to deliver for the mission of the company to be successful, and we're all working towards that. And if you treat people that way, you typically see a better sense of trust and commitment and loyalty, I think, all around, which, you know, is just a way to really make people feel special and part of something bigger than just this boss employee type relationship.
Oh, I agree. Being autocratic is really, you're filling in a gap in your own personality and you just don't realize it. Yes, we need to get things done. So sometimes somebody has to make the final decision, but your talent is understanding where you've hit a wall in coming up with a consensus. I'm a huge synergy fan, and I know people hate that word because it sounds like it came out of a TED talk, but the reality is that synergy is something that is created wherein after you've had the argument or had the discussion, neither one of you individually would have come up with that idea. That idea is the most valuable thing in your company because it only got created by virtue of a bunch of people, the right people getting together at the right time. And your competitors also have that ability or don't have that ability, but that means that everything's riding on one person, and that doesn't create as much value as quickly as you get from a combination of really right-thinking people just trying to come up with what's best for the company to solve the problem. So I'm a big fan of, you know, leaving your ego at the door, but I'm also I'm wary of collective happiness in a room. I just don't like it.
I'm 100% in agreement with you. Like, there should be disagreements. There should be difference of opinion. There should be the conversations around those things. That doesn't mean you scream and yell at each other and belittle each other or anything like that. But conflict, there is healthy conflict, and it moves the needle. It allows you to talk about the tough things and get different perspectives to figure out what's really the right answer versus one person's answer. Like, one of my biggest mistakes that I made at Talent Rover is I never really sought out many other people's opinions. Like, here's where we're going. Let's go, let's go, let's go, get on the bus. And in retrospect, I should have been, let's talk about this more. Give me some diverse opinions here. Which I also think shed the light on, did I really hire the right people? Some of the people were brilliant. A lot of them, those people are still with me today at different companies. But did I really hire the right people that were comfortable enough? And did I give them space in the room, which is, you know, my challenge with that, to speak and be heard and to be able to debate and know that that's okay? Because if we did that, the company would have been 10x what it was.
Yeah, I hear you. I have two failings that I constantly strive to improve myself on. And one of them is I can fall into the habit of sucking the air out of the room. I recognize it. You know, I bartended my way through to pay for college. You know, I do listen, but then sometimes I just say, okay, I get it. And then I just interrupt and I barrel ahead at 400 miles an hour. And I try to make that better. So yeah, you don't want to do that. Really try to just shut up and listen. And that's always a difficult thing for me. The second one is that I do know that, you know, when you hire your core team, think of it as that you're hiring partners, not that you're hiring staff. You're not hiring them so they can do things you don't have time to do. You're hiring them so they can do things you no longer have to worry about. There's a huge difference between those two. And I always, you know, there's that old phrase that, you know, B people hire C people and A people hire A plus people. I mean, always get people who are better at what they do than you are. Because when I started off as an engineer, I was one of those jerks that wore track pants and sandals and long hair and told everybody what they didn't know because they were dumb. And I realized that, every once in a while, I look in a mirror and go, I really hate you. You know, so let's try to figure out what goes on the other side. And only until I went over to the other side where I studied sales, then I realized, wow, these guys have a talent that I don't get. But I recognize it and I recognize the patterns. And so some fool of a guy that I work for, who I have immense respect for, at Fast Search and Transfer, Ali Riaz, he said, you know, Andrew, you should run sales. And I said, I used to be an engineer. How can I run sales? You haven't been an engineer in a long time. And I said, wow, that really hurts. But okay. And we were successful at it because it was just a different view. But the first thing I realized is that the best salespeople we had were the ones that when I was in school, I really didn't like them in high school because they were all the alpha males or whatever they were in your high school, football team and everything else. But boy, do they make great salespeople. Yeah. I'm you know, stereotyping to make a point. But the idea here is that, you know, if you want to hire racehorses, hire the best racehorses. If you want to hire somebody who is your partner, your head of sales or your head of marketing, your head of engineering, make sure they're partners. You know,
I mean, the whole partner approach is similar to what I was talking about, right? We work together, We have different jobs. Let's treat each other like that. How can we make each other successful? You know, talking through this reminds me of a good book that I recently read from Dan Martell called Buy Back Your Time.
And a book that talks about
how you think about hiring people to scale your business and why you hire the people you hire. And it's really fascinating because one of his biggest suggestions for all founders or CEOs is you're probably the most important hire you have is your executive assistant. And really finding an executive assistant who gets rid of or takes care of all of the administrative stuff that just weighs you down. So, for example, reading your email. Like a really good EA would be able to read your email and know what can be handled without you being engaged, and also know what they need to come to you and streamline that whole process for you, as well as just like manage your calendar and all of that. And, you know, a lot of people ask me, like, how am I doing all the things that I'm doing? It's, if I didn't have Barbara, like, I would be lost because she can manages and controls so much of like just the day-to-day admin stuff that would just keep me buried. But the book's really good because he gives you some frameworks to think about when you should hire, when you should not hire, what's the value, how do you measure the value you're going to get from hiring that person, which I thought was really fascinating.
Yeah, I agree. My hiring mantra, and this is really a startup one, is hire when it hurts, right? So you get to a point where it hurts now. I'm spending way too many hours doing way too many things. I need to hire somebody. Now, the best thing to do is say, hire when it hurts and then go back in time somehow for 2 months so that you can ramp them up. But the reality is that you try to anticipate that. And always remember that when you're ready to hire somebody, you still have to train them, get them up to running speed. So factor that time in there. So many founders forget to do that. And so it really does hurt them in that delivery.
It's also quantifying the value of, you know, how much is this task that you're doing worth? Like, how much revenue is it eventually going to make you? And starting to put a number, a dollar amount associated with the task. And then really paying attention to, are you personally working on the highest dollar ROI tasks? Or are you stuck in the very low ones? Because if you're stuck in the low ones, obviously that's not where you want to be. And can you find someone else that can take that work off of your plate to allow you to focus on the higher value task that you should be doing? Like, I'm a big believer in founder sales. Like, I love being in front of customers. I love being on demos. I love just talking and explaining and all that. Because generally, the founders of the business are the best to evangelize the story why you're doing it. You may not be the best salesperson, but the passion, the belief, the why, no one else can tell that story.
Exactly. No, I think you're 100% right. When I think about my role and being able to grow the company, I peel away the tasks that I do from the one that should be torn away first to the last one I'm holding on to, you know. So, you know, you start up a company, you're chief bottle washer and everything else. That's great. What job do you get rid of? Well, you should probably get stopped washing bottles, you know, or you're doing all the QA because you really invented the product. Well, at some point you can hire somebody to do that. And you do that all the way up. My take is that the last one I'll get rid of is product management. And product management is only because you're really charting the future of the product and how it relates back to the world that you sell it to. But the evangelism position, I think, is the one that you should be constantly growing more and more. A thought, especially if you have thought leadership as part of your strategy, which everybody should in today's world, in order to get yourself noticed outside the big throng of voices that are out there now. But mainly, if you're talking about books, the one that I actually liked is Reed Hastings' No Rules, Rules. Reed Hastings, as you know, started Netflix. The reason I like the book is that it aspires to create a company full of people that really are all, you know, all in it for the success of the company, and the success of each other working together is a byproduct, or it's the other way around. You know, the success of each other is a byproduct to create new things, creates the success in the company. But what I like about it is that, you know, he says that you have to build up to this level of trust, but they don't have expense reports. Yes, they do random audits internally, but they trust their people. They don't have vacation time, which a lot of companies are moving to now anyway. But here's one of the ones I found most intriguing. And you have to be able to afford this, and not many companies can. But he would tell his people that if you're going to get an offer from one of our competitors, the only thing I ask you to do is to ask them what they're offering financially. If you can come back with proof of that, I will pay that plus a number on top of it. And I don't care if it's a 30% raise, a 2% raise, or anything. I will pay the top dollar for your role. And the reason he did that, as he says in his book, is that, you know, there are groups of people that are very much operational. It's in-tray, out-tray stuff. And studies have shown that maybe the best person in that particular role is perhaps 250% more efficient, more contributing to revenue than the average. But the creative roles, the factors of multiples of how much better they are huge. So if you always have the top people in your creative roles, theoretically, you're going to be vastly more profitable and more successful because their difference in contribution to that role than, say, a peer in another company. And that's something that he built Netflix on. Now, there are, you know, wonderful levels of detail in that are pluses and minuses, but the reality is that he did something pretty well there. And I've been intrigued by that model.
Yeah, I've got to read that one. I haven't read that one. I love reading business books, so that's going to get added to my list. So, well, we're coming up on just a 5 minutes or so left on the show, and I would love to ask this question. What do you think other founders or execs should be focused on right now?
Okay, so I'll mention it in three. There's AI, no surprise, SaaS, no surprise, and Agile. Now, again, these three are all, well, duh, but I'll tell you what they actually mean. Agile is more than just engineering for your product. And think of what agile marketing and agile sales mean. Here's an example. My wife has just given up on filling our dishwasher because every time she does, I inevitably go in there and I change it.
I know what that's like. I do the same thing.
I'm in autopilot. And I can't stop myself sometimes because I'll actually look at something and go, really, should I change it? But I do anyway.
Well, it's kind of like, why would you put that there?
But you know what I do is I just do it. So she gave up. So it's a blank canvas for me now. But the reality is that, so in the end she wins, I suppose. But the reality is that, you know, always be learning, always be trying to find a better way to do anything, no matter if it's making your bed or it's how better to push our product in some particular vertical market. And it can be just a micro change, but you look back over the last 2 years for 3 years of your history at that particular thing, and you realize that it has changed dramatically. It just didn't happen overnight. And I'm a big fan of change is a constant, not an event, right? So plan yourself accordingly and throughout your operations. And that's agility. That's what real agility is. Now, it doesn't mean that you're chaos all the time. People have this idea that Agile is like the wild, wild west and it has less control than the old traditional waterfall models. No, actually, it's the opposite. It has far more control because you have to have that discipline in order to make Agile successful or to have agility, because if you don't, you're going to fall right off the rails. So that's the Agile side, and that begets operational efficiency. There's so many technologies out there that can help run your company. Actually invest early on. This is what we're doing right now. We're actually talking to people right now that we're going to 1099 at the beginning, but we can see a path into the company. That's another aside that I always recommend, is that even when you 1099 people for temporary jobs, always pick the people that you can see how they might actually join the company for a full-time role as a W-2 down the road. And you always find better people that way. But in this particular case, we're actually finding somebody to say, look, I need somebody to come in here and become our system administrator for Salesforce.org because I can't do that anymore. So why don't we get somebody to do that? But meanwhile, we're also using Jira, we're also using Slack, and we're also using three or four other applications, Monday.com, a few others. And we want to make sure that they are all tied together in some way, because I'm a huge proponent of single entry. I hate double entry systems where you put the same information in three different places manually three times. I just don't like it. One, because I have a really terrible memory, so I'd like to know where it is and I can find it. And two, it's just because it's waste. So I would like to suggest that everybody, or recommend that everybody, actually think about that seriously and early on in their company's career to get the systems right. Because when the flood hits you, you know, then your number one goal is going to be, don't screw it up. All of these new opportunities, all of this new information is coming in. If you've got an efficient system running already, then that means you can survive the wave.
Yeah, and the more that you can focus on actually building the business versus fixing the challenges that you're now uncovering. And, you know, that's we could have a whole show on that whole topic. But my friend, we are out of time. So
the only thing I'll add one last thing on this. The SaaS side is obvious. The only thing I'll say on the AI side is everybody, and maybe I'll just leave with, I'm burying the lead, but generative AI through ChatGPT and OpenAI is transformative for us, but don't believe all the hype. We've been running LLMs and vector queries for some time in the search industry, but it's very powerful. And like all great, powerful things, they could be used for good and they can be used for evil. So be thoughtful in how you integrate it into your company.
And have a plan. Like, I think every CEO needs to have a plan for AI and what they're going to do with it. I'm excited to see a lot of the stuff that Salesforce is doing as they're talking about what I think is the most important thing is the trust element. Like, it's your data. You want to protect your data. You don't want everyone else to have your data. So making sure that when you're starting to look at AI, like, how is your data protected? How is it going to be used? How is it anonymized? All of those different types of things. But AI is going to, like, generative AI is going to change how business works. And I totally agree with you. Get past all the hype. And, you know, right now everything's AI, AI, AI. But there's real merit to some of the innovation that's coming if you really dig in to understand what they're actually trying to accomplish and how does that actually solve real life business problems and business challenges versus, you know, what we saw back in the dot-com bubble, where everyone had a dot-com all of a sudden and it was this revolutionary thing, but most of them were just worthless and didn't have enough meaning to actually make anything successful. So, but with that, I will see you on Thursday. We're going to have a good time, and thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, Brandon. Wonderful meeting you, and we have a great relationship, and I can see us, we can see us taking pictures in London at the party and making sure that we don't hand them out to anybody.
I'll do that. So for everyone else, Cash and Burn comes out every Tuesday. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.